previously on Wisco Weekly.
One of the neat things about not having our commission salespeople is that none of the traditional car salesmen work for me anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because no one wanted to deal with him. And those guys didn't have enough motivation in a place, in a facility, in a business like mine that that kept him intrigued enough to want to work here. And we just didn't align together in how I feel like a customer should be dealt with excellence, with this kind of elegance and ease of just taking some great care of someone at your house. Just. And you happen to really have this investment in time, so whether they're here today to buy or not shouldn't matter, and it doesn't matter. And that would never happen at a normal car dealership. That's different. And I like that difference.
And on this episode.
Look, I want them, if a customer wants it, I want them to buy it. If they see a value in it and they want it, by all means, I don't want the customer to go without. There are some people that come in there to buy a car and all they can afford is $300 a month. I would rather them stretch to $320 to have a warranty on that, knowing that they can't pay their $300 car payment plus a $500 car repair. It would put them in the poorhouse. That is the customer that should buy a warranty.
This is Wisco Weekly, an automobility and advanced transportation podcast where we feature the voices and issues that are shaping the way we travel and commute.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown, chicken brown cow. Listeners, welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly, giving you the news, society, and culture in automobility and advanced transportation. And today's show is going to be a great eye-opening, thought-provoking topic, as one of the things that's, I believe, always going to be around in the immediate and distant future are cars. And so because cars will be around, people will need to buy cars, there is a particular process in which individuals buy cars that has improved, but yet there are certain elements that have not been improved. Now, I'm talking in very vague terms. I know and I understand that. I get that. But we will bring more clarity to the car buying process in just a moment. Before we get there and before we get to our guest, just some news here, some updates. So a couple weeks ago, back in late May, May 23rd to be exact, there was an event at the Container Yard in downtown Los Angeles that was put on by Ford. It was called the Ford City of Tomorrow Symposium. Most events of this nature are usually put on by either the city or some type of think tank. Rarely does an automaker host an event like this. And of the eight or so sessions that were going on in this particular day, it was no surprise that the most attended session of the day was the one hosted by Bill Ford, who is the executive chairman of Ford and who has been leading the company for the last 20 years. He did a 5-minute keynote, which, to be honest, I wasn't all impressed with it. If you'd like, you can visit our YouTube channel and you can see and hear his keynote at this event. But to me, it just seemed as if he was recycling this speech that was rewritten to fit this particular audience. But the key takeaway from his keynote was highlighting Ford's acquisition of Michigan's Grand Central Station and their plans to develop this new asset to fit the mobility culture. In addition, on this day, one of the more thought-provoking conversations I found that took place, it actually occurred at two different sessions, but in my head, I kind of imagined that both speakers were on the same sessions and talking about the same topic, just with their different viewpoints. Joshua Schenck is the Chief Innovation Officer at LA Metro, and Kate Gallegos is the Mayor of Phoenix. And they both share a common interest in developing mass transit in urban environments. Urban environments are a place to play safe, to freely move, and to keep the environment as attractive as possible in order to cater to existing residents and to promote business, though they differ on the manner in which to achieve this. Schenck believes that when it comes to existing infrastructure and to make available the infrastructure and to make it beneficial to all, then you must adopt some of the punitive fees that would charge drivers to fund transit projects, which do not have an immediate benefit to the driver. The argument, of course, to the driver would be that, well, the more people you could get off the road and onto public transit, then that means that's one less car on the road for a driver to have a better commute. Although there's one part of that sentence that's kind of left off, and that is, if I were to say that that's one less car on the road for a driver to have a better commute, the missing part would be 20 years from now. Kate Gallegos, on the other hand, believes in the power of diversity and diversity in an urban environment. And the more you cater to a diverse audience, the greater the opportunity to flourish as a city. She advocates for mass transit as well, which should be supported by the public through their votes. And to this end, they will have a fourth vote to confer the development and expansion of a light rail system through an increased tax. So two public officials, two different ideas on a mobility culture in their own urban environments. Again, visit YouTube or Twitter or Facebook and you can see some of the videos that I've posted on this event. And so let's get to today's guest. It's not hard to introduce today's guest. He's been with the same auto group for 20 years. And more than half of that time was spent as a general manager. Let's not forget the demands of a general manager of a mass market franchise store where they sell a product which comprises as the second highest purchase amounts of an individual, second to real estate. In automotive retail, a general manager performs daily transactions. These transactions usually occur in the form of a buyer and a seller. But there are other transactions that are not as visible to the public and specifically to the customer. There are constant negotiations taking place at a retail store, an employee griping about pay, a dissatisfied customer on their dealership experience, an unrealistic sales target by the OEM, or the incessant oversight of the spreadsheet owner. There, after 30 years in the business, he is now self-retired with the sort of fond appreciation and deep wisdom that he wants to pass on. Men, women, and children, here to share greater insight into the finance and insurance process, please welcome to the show, Mr. Derek Manis. Hello, sir.
Hello, sir.
So, Derek, we're able to reconnect after so long. Just a quick anecdotal story. Derek and I briefly met when I had a brief stop in Indiana, and I was working at a company at the time who was serving as when he was a general manager of this of his dealership. The company I was working for was a website provider. So I popped in, said hello. He was absolutely shocked. I mean, the look on his face was like, nobody's ever visited me from our website provider. It's so great to see you. I mean, I felt like he was like really needing a hug. And I think we did hug it out. But that was kind of our initial connection to one another. And since then, we've kind of shared a kinship to one another in terms of how we see the dealership world, how we see the customer experience. Derek, first off, you're not as active on social media. Do you have any proper channels that people can touch base with you on or follow up or, you know, get to know Derek Manis?
No, I mean, after spending nearly over half my life in a dealership, I didn't have a lot of time for that kind of stuff. So it may be something I dabble in. I do have a YouTube channel where I, that's kind of one of my hobbies is making videos. So I do have a YouTube channel, though off the top of my mind, I can't tell you exactly what my screen name is, but I think it's my name.
Okay. Well, we'll get that YouTube channel and I'll put that on the episode notes, for people to take. I guess what can people expect on your YouTube channel?
Some dog videos. I've taken up kayaking since I've left. I've got a couple videos up there. Recently found a bald eagle's nest when I was out on the river and made a video about that. That was my most recent upload. So
awesome.
a documentary might be in the works. I've kind of thought that. I'm kind of getting out there on the water. I've thought that may be something that I'd like to do. So I don't know. Stay tuned on that.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, Derek, so you have an extraordinary amount of experience and insight into a dealership operation. You were the GM of a Toyota store for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And you, in a lot of ways, you can argue that you were able to perfect a system that accommodated all parties as best as possible. But yet there were still some struggles along the way that you were fighting, and part of that is what we will kind of discuss today. So mm-hmm. as we maybe we don't all know this, but as part of the car buying process, in addition to doing all the research, in addition to visiting the store and test driving, once you've negotiated the price, there's kind of that last part of the process called the F&I process, which stands for finance and insurance. And so to lead this off, Derek, I thought through your eyes, you can start by telling us, you know, let's define this finance and insurance process. And especially since you've been in the business for so long, maybe give us some context of what this F&I process was 20 years ago and what it looks like now.
So getting into finance was my first managerial duty in a dealership. I went from sales to finance, first as a backup and then to a full-time. So that was my evolution into management initially. So obviously when you're first getting in, you're pretty subservient to whatever they want to do, and you don't have a lot of leverage to make changes. But when I go back in time and look, mainly then the dealer was making money off the finance reserve, meaning off the bank. So the customer would get approved for 4%. You could mark up rates up to 5% higher at the time. There wasn't a lot of government oversight as to how much you could mark it up. And that is where the dealer made the bulk of the money. That's where I made the bulk of my money in the finance office. They also
now there is a little bit more oversight in the markup though, right? Again, at least if we fast forward to maybe not today, but at least maybe 10 years ago, 5% sure. is not necessarily the markup anymore, correct?
No, I don't. I'm quite certain there's no one that's legally allowed to mark a yeah. rate up 5% any longer. 1% or 2% might be some banks. And again, I don't know that that is a federal law. I just know that the banks will tell you, here's your approval. You can mark it up to 2% higher than this. But I think two is the maybe three. I can't imagine there's anybody higher than three. But at the end of the day, that's where the bulk of the money was made. You could still, obviously, extended warranties have been around for a long time. We had extended warranties back then. And then we had life and disability insurance. Disability insurance would be if you were laid off from your job or hurt for some reason and couldn't work, then the disability insurance would kick in and pay your car payment. Life insurance would be if you died, it would pay the car off. Those went away. Those are no longer in play. And I go again, I don't know whether that's regulatory or why they went away, but those are gone, long gone. Now we have extended warranties. We still have rate reserve. You've got gap insurance, tire and wheel, windshield replacement, key replacement, paint and fabric protection, dent and ding. There's so many products now that are, you know, that are there so that the dealer can have profit.
And, you know, I'll get to this point later, but it, you know, as you itemize the list of products, you know, the overwhelmingly the perception of these products are a waste. I do though want to ask you later on, we'll get to that, what your personal thoughts are of these products. And perhaps we can look at it both from a dealer perspective and also from, you know, a customer perspective, in which you as a dealership, you would have to service those particular items to the customer. Okay, so, all right, so we've kind of covered what the F&I process was back 20 years ago, what it looked like, what it looks like today. Now, there's a particular part of this F&I process, though, the part that consumers don't see that is maybe somewhat controversial, maybe just informative?
You know, anybody that has bought a car in the last couple of years, I would think that if they said, rate your time at the dealership and what was the best, assuming they had a relatively decent salesperson, I would say that at least 90% would rate the worst part of the process as that finance experience, as the time in the finance office. And mainly because that is where the highest amount of pressure comes in. You may find a high pressure car salesperson, but you know, I've worked in my own dealership for so long. I think those days are pretty much gone. I don't find a lot. I didn't have any. I don't think there's a lot of people that are out there trying to trap somebody in the dealership to buy the car. Granted, they're going to try to sell the car. That's their job, and they want to sell it, or they can't make a commission. But once the customer commits to the car, going into that finance office is where there's the most amount of pressure. So,
and the pressure you speak of, is it along the lines of the dealership F&I person applying pressure? Is it a pressure that the customer feels by virtue of knowing what's going to happen? And you know, it, again, maybe most customers, because they do not look favorably at these F&I products, they just want to say no, but they have to sit through the spiel. And so therefore it's like, oh my God, okay, well, maybe if I just say yes to this one, I can get out of here and I can leave.
I think that. I mean, if they've had a prior experience, they know what's coming. So there's that dread, even though they haven't walked in yet. And then if they do go in and they do want to just say no, for example, at our dealership, we had a disclosure form. So regardless if the customer walked in and said, look, I've been here 16 times, I don't want any of your stuff, they would still have to disclose, here's what they are, so that they could sign the form and say, look, I don't want it. I've been told about it. I'm signing my waiver. I don't want it. That way, in the dealer's defense, if there are those rogue customers who would come back 2 years later with a problem and say, well, I was never offered an extended warranty. Well, yes, you were. And here's your signature saying that you didn't want it. So I know that that happens, but again, you're making policy based on a fraction, 0.00001 amount of customers would come back and try to pull some sort of scam, like they weren't offered an extended warranty. But, you know, so they make rules based on those low percentages, but I feel it's to justify what they do, which is to put extreme pressure on a customer to build profit, because the margins have shrunk on the front side, and this is a way to replace that.
So to back up one step here, the front side or the front end for car sales is the actual sale of the car, which, as we know in the industry, those profit margins have been declining significantly, especially on the new car end. Used cars, usually you can make more money. But it's this back end, this second half of the process, when the customer is in the F&I shop, that this is where dealers know that they can make, this is where they're making their money. And so therefore there is a little more of, again, that high pressure sale for the customer to transact in that back end process, right?
That's right. So the front side would be, you buy the car, you buy running boards, you buy window tint. That's the front. You're buying basically the car, anything goes with it. The backside is the banking side, the banking and the insurance being the warranties.
And so this backside, this back end and the pressure applied in this process, in your eyes, is ruining the customer experience. Would that be a fair assessment? Am I simplifying it too much?
I don't know that I would use the word ruin, but I would say definitely it hurts the process. I'll give you an example. We had the highest Google review score of any dealership that I could find. And it's not like we had 25 reviews. There's 800 and some odd reviews when I left. And our score was super high. But whenever I would get a bad one, 90% of them were related to the experience in finance. So it isn't like I just kind of figured I'm trying to be Nostradamus and think what my customers are thinking. I know what they're thinking based on the reviews and what people told me. So this is factual information. I know the customer disliked that part of the process of more than any other part of it.
And so, I mean, you're a general manager though. So you're seeing this, you're seeing the reviews that 90% of them are bad reviews. You are head of this dealership.
Right. So it was mine early on. What I decided to do was to try to cut some of this out. Now I was part of a dealer group. So there's multiple dealers within the organization. And I obviously was just the general manager of one of those stores. I had a boss. He was the general manager of the entire group. He had a boss, which is the owner. So above me, they wanted the numbers to be at a certain point. So just like if you say on the front side, if you were averaging $700 or $800 profit per car, on the back side, they wanted to average $1,100 or $1,200 per car. So that was always something I had to fight, but I had a game plan. I thought, well, my theory was if I could clean up the process, clean up what the customers dislike, when the customer left and was thrilled and didn't even go through the pain of the finance process, though they had to go through the pain in the sense they had to sign paperwork, which you can only make that as fun as you can possibly make mm-hmm. it. It's just something you have to do to buy a car. So I don't know that can ever be turned into something thrilling, but to make it as painless as possible by taking the pressure away, you still had to offer it. Legally, I was bound to have those legal forms signed that said, yes, I was offered. No, I don't want it. Or yes, I do. There are times when I think it's relevant for people that they need a warranty. If there are certain brands that even if I was involved, if I sold a family member, for example, if I sold a family member a Chrysler because they wanted it, I'm begging them to buy a warranty. I don't want to be the one dealing with the drama that they've got this $2,500 repair. Now they want to make me feel guilty because I sold it to them. And I would upfront tell them, look, here is my opinion on that brand. I would definitely want it to be covered. But at the end of the day, my way was to take that away, take that pressure away, or at least minimize it to as small as I could do it and keep my job. And with that, when the customer left and they were happy, happier than they had ever been buying a car, they told people. And those people that they told came in to check us out. And so that was my theory. Clean it up, make them happy, the word will get out, and people will come in droves. And though your per car dollar is lower, so for example, 100 cars sold at $1,400 per copy is less money than $800 per copy for 200 cars sold. So that was my theory. I'll make up for the loss in per car profit by selling more cars. And that's what we did. And if anybody could look it up, you would see that we went from being the smallest Toyota store in the Chicago region, which encompasses four states, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota, to becoming the largest store in Indiana and Illinois. We could not beat Maplewood in Minnesota. They were the largest, but we came second place. So that, to go from 120 dealers and to be number 120, to go to be a number two. And I honestly believe, give me another year or two, I could have took out the number one dealer. I was done, and I had accomplished enough. And so that's how I did it. And I believe it's easily replicatable, and I believe it's the right thing to do.
Why do you believe it's, I mean, I guess it's obvious why it's the right thing to do. It's better for the customer, but
yeah.
But at the same time, you also have a boss. If you, I mean, like the reality is now you have the benefit of hindsight and wisdom, where there are other dealer executives in your position that may not be as fortunate as you to have been successful in your operation, and to also potentially find a way to fight the powers that be and yet still keep their job. You know, if you are advising some of these other dealer executives who are in the same spot where they're being, you know, they have the high pressure of their bosses and the owners to say, hey, you need increased profit in that F&I. And how would you advise these dealer executives to operate so as to maintain a profitable store and placate to their boss, but also placate to the customer?
Look, I mean, I know all owners are different, but I believe that, you know, I see these articles in Automotive News, and dealers are, you know, finance numbers are up. If you look over the past 5 years, dealers are raising their per car average. In fact, I think it's at its all-time high right now. And how they're doing that is by doing the pressure and adding more products in there to try to sell more products. But again, I think that it's a ticking time bomb, because the credibility of those products, the usefulness of them, is questionable. Key replacement, for example, if you're going to sell a policy for $300 or $400 for key replacement, the customer could buy a key for less. Now they need to lose their key two or three times, then yes, that product becomes valuable. Same with tire and wheel. You're selling a tire and wheel policy for $700 or $800. How many tires do they have to pop to pay for the policy and then make it worthwhile? It's going to take several tires. So that to me is the things that are being done currently to try to raise those numbers are going to come back to haunt them. That's my personal opinion. And, you know, again, you're talking to somebody that had the authority to do all the things that I'm telling you are wrong, but chose not to, because I knew it would hurt in the long run. And I had to live with myself, as did my team. And so by doing things better, by doing things different, I believe it's why we grew so fast. To put it in perspective, you'll see sometimes dealerships build a new store. We built a brand new store in 2009, and then again in 2018. So within 9 years, had to build another brand new store to contain the growth. That's how fast we grew, from having 3 acres to having 11 acres of cars. And so again, I've got proof that this way works. I've also got proof that it's more profitable. We weren't, okay, again, in that dealer group organization, we got to have monthly meetings where we got to say, hey, this store has this much finance per car money, this, and the Toyota store is at this much per car finance money. However, because our volume was so much higher, the number one guy who had the highest per car did not have the amount of money in the pot that the Toyota store had with nearly half the per car profit. So if the number one store was at 1400, we would hover somewhere 700 or 800, half, and still made more money because we sold double the amount of cars, or more than double the amount of cars. And that, to me, made up for it, cleaned up the process. Employees are happier, customers are happier, managers are happier. And ethically, I just think everybody felt cleaner.
Let's talk about this from an operational perspective. So when you were looking to implement this philosophy where you wanted to, where you are okay with taking less on the back end in order to gain another customer, which would, again, either balance or give you more profit than another dealership in the same auto group. From an operational perspective, what were the ways that you implemented that at your dealership? So meaning like, what, you know, was there a lot, you know, were F&I managers upset because you were taking away from their paycheck? So then you had to compromise with them in X manner. Can you maybe share some of the operational elements of how you implemented your philosophies at your store?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it was initially a little bit more difficult on the finance manager, on a financial side, because ultimately he wasn't making as much money because the pay plans are based on a per car dollar. So based on where you're at, if you're the 1400 guy, you're maxing out the percentage of that money they're going to give you. Where if you're down 700 or 800, you're getting paid a much smaller percentage, though they're still making decent money. And that's ultimately what it boiled down to. I think I lost two or three when we started shifting what we were going to do. And then the people that came in, it's kind of a trade-off. Is that you've got a much better job because you're not under the high pressure. You don't have a general manager beating you up saying, sell more of your stuff, get your per car dollar up or else. So their jobs weren't threatened. As long as I felt the customer was being asked, being presented, look, I want them, if a customer wants it, I want them to buy it. If they see a value in it and they want it, by all means, I don't want the customer to go without. There are some people that come in there to buy a car and all they can afford is $300 a month. I would rather them stretch to $320 to have a warranty on that, knowing that they can't pay their $300 car payment plus a $500 car repair. It would put them in the poorhouse. That is the customer that should buy a warranty. But a guy coming in there writing a check for the car, he can self-insure. A $2,000 repair is like taking $2 out of his pocket. He doesn't feel it. That guy should not be buying it and typically doesn't, but he shouldn't have to sit in there and get his head beat in begging him to buy it. Mm-hmm. And they were instructed 6 or 7 no's before they can let the customer leave. Do not let them walk on one no. And so that financial side, yes, was a little bit less. My finance managers didn't make as much as the other stores I'm telling you about. But I think they had a better quality of life overall, and that they had less pressure, and they were doing something with credibility and with good ethics.
So if we look at the evolution of the dealership and how, you know, you could say that there was a time where you had the high pressure sale on the front end that kind of whittled away. It wasn't good for the customer. Now you have more product specialists, hourly employees coming in, but yet you still on the F&I process, you had the high pressure sale. It's still going on, but would you also see that at this F&I end that you would have more of a whatever F&I specialist, an hourly employee that's, you know, again, now you kind of deal with another dichotomy in the business where you have somebody who is getting paid by the hour. And so in terms of selling products, they might not be as good at it versus the commission-based employee who, because that they get paid through the products they sell, they're going to be a little bit more aggressive. Do you see the F&I process evolving to that?
I think so. And I think that's why this conversation is relevant, because I think that's the way it's going to go. I don't think currently... today, if you open Automotive News, I will bet you there's an article in there about dealers raising their finance average. Right now, that seems to be the profit center that the dealers are looking at to keep making more money. But I feel we're on the cusp of it. This is just now coming in. The disruptors like Vroom, are changing the way that they do it with a cleaner approach. Carvana doing the same thing. And I think that it's just a matter of time before the dealers are forced into it. Look, it's the internet that helped clean up the front side. It's hard now. A customer just goes online. If they see your car is $3,000 higher than the car down the road, they're not coming into your dealership. And so I think it's just a matter of time before these types of things are more disclosed, because right now they're not. Finding the actual cost, you can find the cost of what the dealer pays for their cars easily online. Every site in the world, Edmunds, they'll KBB, they'll show what the invoice of the car is. You can easily find it. So if you want to give the dealer a $300 or $400 profit, you can do it. If you say, look, I'll give you your invoice plus a few hundred, or if you can ask him for less than invoice. It's easy for you to negotiate from a position of cost rather than from a position of MSRP, asking price. It is much more difficult to find that on a warranty, to where a customer could say, here's what the dealers pay for these warranties. So to give them a fair profit on it, if they want to give you $100 or $200 over cost on your warranty, I don't know that you can even find the cost online. So again, this is more of a protected profit center for the dealers right now. It's somewhere that they can make the profit that customers really don't know if $3,500 for an extended warranty is a good deal or not, because it's hard to compare that.
That's such good info and insight in the way that actually you explain that. So thank you for that.
Let's
maybe talk about the actual products here. And I understand this will vary per user. Again, you use the example of where somebody, a family member, in which I always feel like this is always the dealership culture and mentality, in that if you sell a car to your friend or a family member, I mean, first off, you almost want to not do that unless maybe it's a new car. Because obviously, or not obviously, but if something goes wrong with that car, then you, as the person that sold it to your family member or your friend, kind of get that guilty feeling like, oh, they're going to blame it on me and I feel bad. And it's, you know, just every which way is a wrong position. But you did say, though, that in a case where if somebody can only afford a $300 payment, usually then if that, you know, generally speaking, that $300 payment would associate to somebody who, they're probably living paycheck to paycheck. They need a car for work. So to bump their payment from 300 to 320 to get the warranty is a very, very safe, smart thing to do. But you also mentioned there are things like key replacement, tire replacement. Let's talk about some of those products and just maybe give me your oversight or your understanding of those products, and, you know, maybe a yes or no, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down to those products. So we talked about key replacement already. Basically, I would say that's a thumbs down.
Yeah, key replacement is a thumbs down. Just protect your damn keys and don't buy it.
It's simple,
you know,
yeah.
Unless they'll sell it to you for $10 or something ridiculous like that. I mean, where you know it's a value. Again, part of that... not only is it a protected profit center, they almost protect the larcenous aspect of that. In that, on that key replacement, the finance person knows what a key costs. There are companies like Car Keys Express that will come into the dealership once a week. And for example, we had a Toyota store. We could easily make a key for a Toyota, if we took a trade-in in and the customer said, hey, sorry, I lost a key, I only have one, but we want to provide two keys for our customers, which was a mandate of our dealership. I mandated that two keys come with every used car.
Sorry, real quick.
So,
sorry, Derek.
Real quick,
along those lines, listeners, just as a quick tip, if you are buying a used car, definitely as like one of your first items of priority to look into, just ensure there are two keys to that car, because it always happens that you're so excited about the car, you get the car, you get the one key, and like either at the very end of the buying process or a week later, you ask about that second key and it just sours everything. So be sure you do look out for that second key, because in the case of, well, in Derek's case, it was great that that was standardized at his store. I can say that that is not a standard practice amongst all dealers. So sorry, Derek, go ahead.
But so this company would come in and they would make keys for other brands as well. So if we traded for a BMW and we can't obviously cut keys for a BMW at a Toyota store, this company comes in and makes second keys for all of our cars. They come in once a week. They make keys for nearly half the price that even we could do it through the parts department. So we could get a smart key for a Toyota or a Honda for roughly $150, $175. That service is available to the consumer. So again, if they're paying $300 or $400 for a key policy, you can see that there is not a value play there. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the windshield or the dent and ding. They're charging $400 or $500 for a dent and ding policy, but you can get a dent popped out of a quarter panel for $40-$50. I mean, how many dents can you get popped? Early on, when they implemented that product, shortly after selling some of those, we would have a customer come in and say, "Hey, I've got this ding." They would come in for an oil change and say, "Hey, why it's here? I've got this ding since I bought this policy." Well, they'd bring their little placard out and say, "Oh, it's too big. It's bigger than your little circle here." Well, they didn't know how big the circle was. You see, because they don't have time to disclose all that intricate detail. So that's not a covered repair. Well, now how does the customer feel? Now they may just look back through their paperwork, see how much they spent on it, say, "What the hell?" And now what's their opinion of the dealership? How much credibility does the dealership lose? Yes, they might have made $250 worth of profit to sell that ding policy, but it is gone. Whatever that profit, you have just lost how much that customer may never come back, may not even come back for service again, because for $250, you just lost a customer for life. To me, that's why if I didn't see value, there's no way I'm pushing it, and there's no way I'm asking somebody to sell it.
I mean, I got goosebumps there because that hammered home exactly your point of why this F&I process is, on one hand, from the, you know, from the higher ups that be, just a complete profit center, but you, who's on the operational level, who has to deal with customers and employees, like, there is almost this moral authority that you have to take on this because you're the ones that's looking them in the eye and telling them, "Yeah, sorry, that ding and dent replacement program product that you bought, unfortunately, this ding is a little bit bigger than the program. So sorry, it's not covered. You got to pay out of pocket still." I mean, I empathize for you to have those conversations. You can never have that conversation enough times for it to feel good to tell a customer that basically what they bought is not going to properly service them or is not going to be of value to them. So what are some other products that you can share some insight on? Ding and dent.
We talk ding and dent, we talk key, we talk windshield. Mm-hmm. None of those I would do. And I would tell you that, like, sometimes in these trainings for the finance people, everybody was asked to do like a throwaway policy. So that basically meaning this, that customer comes into your office, you're the finance person, customer comes into your office, they're required to go through and explain, "Here's all the things that you can buy. Here's your payment. And then if you add the warranty, here's your payment. If you add the windshield and the key and the tire and wheel and the gap and everything, here's your payment." But they had to explain what each product is. But to gain credibility, the finance person might say, "Look, this key thing, I'm not a big fan. Let's throw that out." And what that does is that adds some credibility to them, that they say, "Well, they didn't find value in that, but they do in this. Maybe this is a good deal." Because I do think that people expect the best out of people. I mean, they expect that somebody that's in a position of authority is going to try to at least do the right thing. Tire and wheel is one where I can see some value in that if it's sold at a reasonable price, especially with the way our roads are right now. And I think that's why this infrastructure bill and in the government right now is on, you know, it's up front and center, because everybody knows. I've been driving for 30 plus years, and I have never seen roads this bad. However, you have multiple brands of tire and wheel coverage. For example, we sold at our dealership, we sold the Toyota policy, and we sold a secondary insurance policy. The secondary insurance policy would not cover cosmetic damage. If the tire would seal onto the rim, they didn't care what it looked like. It was not going to cover the rim. Toyota would cover the rim. So, you know, based on the coverage, you just have to be really informed to know if you're getting a good deal. But I would say I hate to say this, but 90% certainty you're not getting a good deal on that product because they marked it up so high that you're never going to get your money's worth out of it. But I think for a consumer to protect themselves, it'd be really simple to do. You just walk out with your phone to the car you're buying, Google the tire that's on the car you're buying. It's going to probably, if you just Google Michelin P23570R16, I bet the first thing comes up is a price, you know, on Google. You're going to see what the tire cost. And then you're going to know when the finance guy said, hey, if it's a $160 tire and the finance guy asks $795 for his tire and wheel policy, you're going to know it's not a good deal and don't buy the damn thing. You know, unless you plan on popping five tires. I will tell you, I've been driving over 30 years. I've never had a blowout. So there's no way you couldn't sell me a tire and wheel policy for $20. I wouldn't do it unless I really liked the finance person and just wanted to help them out.
And it literally costs $20.
And it literally costs $20. And I know there's a value play. And I just might try to hit a curb on purpose just to cover, just to get something that's covered.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, this is actually very, very good insight. So, listeners, I hope you're paying attention to the different products that would be offered in the F&I and to hear some of the insight from a former general manager who has been well-versed in these areas and who has always wanted to do right by the customer and also do right by his dealership operation and trying to be able to, you know, be fair about how he does business. So, Derek, maybe I want to pivot a little bit actually to you now, because you have adopted a moral authority when you did work at your dealership. Can you maybe share what were some of how did you come to your guiding principles? Were there books, mentors, individuals that really kind of shaped your moral compass?
Well, I mean, Dennis, keep in mind, I told you that my dealership was more profitable than the dealership that was making $1,400 per copy in the finance office. So it isn't that I was not trying to make money. I just wanted to make it a good, clean way. So again, they're doing this show. I mean, I doubt the owner of the dealership that I worked for listens to podcasts. He very well may, but you know, there's a fine line I need to walk here. I like the man, you know, I just think he's misinformed as to why he would want to have so much finance money, because I just think he gets his education from sources like Automotive News. And this is what all his owner buddies, you know, these guys that own all these stores, they talk to each other. Well, where are you at on finance? Where are you at on new cars? Where are you at on used cars? They compare these things and they just think it's relevant. And they're not the guy that's trying to high pressure you in it. And I don't think that they really think too deeply about what the consumer is going through in that office, nor what the employee that's doing it is going through to get to the numbers that they want them to get to. So I almost excuse them a little bit, but it's a fine line I walk here because I don't want to alienate him. And I don't want to portray dealership owners as just these horrible criminals, because I don't think, truly, I don't think it's that bad, though I do believe there's truly some just larcenous pieces of garbage out there that are just don't care about anybody, employees or customers, and just want to get every dime they can. For me, it was about making a good living. I wanted to justify working 75 or 80 hours a week. So I wanted to make decent money, but I wanted to make it as clean as possible. And to be the cleanest dealer in town is not a difficult thing to do, because it is a pretty dirty industry. So to clean it up is not hard to do. So I wouldn't, though I appreciate you, Dennis, wanting to make me out to be some, you know, ethical knight in shining armor, I don't know that I would go that far, though I would say that I would, with pretty strong conviction, say I was the most honest car dealer I've ever met.
Well, I actually appreciate the balance that you brought to my question, because I think certainly that there, you know, like you said, I don't think that dealerships in general are out to, you know, just absolutely make a killing off of customers and then disregard every other aspect of their operation. Is there a few of them. Are there a minority? Sure, but there's always going to be bad players in any space.
Yeah.
Though at the same time, I do believe that there are a lot of dealer executives who maybe don't have that moral clarity yet, who are still being guided by philosophies, who are still being guided by news sources that they like you said, they just don't think very deeply about. And obviously you have. And so, you know, then this again gets back to where, what is it about what you have done, things you've learned that has caused you to think more deeply about how you work and hence how you live?
Well, I mean, I think there's part of it is just my personal beliefs. I mean, I do believe karma. I mean, what you reap, what you sow. I believe what goes around comes around. And I knew one day I would be the consumer. And I just, you know, there's part of it that's that I wanted, I just deep down wanted to do the right thing. And if I truly could have just given every customer everything it cost, I would probably have done it, though I would have never kept my job very long and I wouldn't have made a living. So we're just in a world of profit. Profit isn't a bad word. We have to have it. The dealers have to have it to make a living, but they just don't have to have as much as possible. And look, if I could speak directly to dealers, I would just say to you dealers, if you changed your principles to the things that I'm talking about, you're not going to lose your jet. You're not going to lose your magnificent mansions. You are simply, maybe you'll die with $39.2 million instead of $41.7 million. You're never going to notice the difference. You're going to be just fine. It isn't going to be detrimental to do what's right. And that's what I feel like I prove. No one can argue with the success of that store. So anybody saying, yeah, this guy, you know, he's an idiot or he just couldn't do it and that's why he's saying this stuff. Look, it's much easier to do it the other way. You know, it's much easier just to join the crowd and do it the same old way. I had to fight to do it a different way because I wanted to do it a right way. And I thought a cleaner way, better for the consumer, better for me, better for the other employees. And I think in the end, it was better for the owner. It went from being, when I hired onto that store, it was his worst performing store out of 9. And today, fast forward, it's his number one store by far. And so try to argue with it. Good luck. It's going to be really difficult to make a case against what I'm talking about. But as far as my motivation, number one, what I believe, my belief system, my core beliefs. Number two, I am a salesperson at heart. So what happened is when I did get into management, I feel like my number one successful trait was that I always thought of the front line. What is best for salespeople? What is going to be the best for them? Because they are the ones that are out there fighting it every day. They're the ones that are out there that don't get paid unless they sell something. You know, a lot of the positions in the dealership, they get paid whether cars are sold or not. You know, and these guys were the ones out there that were fighting, and I wanted to do best by them. And so I kept a salesperson mindset, even as a manager. And I always tried to think of what was best for them. Obviously, your typical motivation and selling books, like from Tony Robbins. I read Awaken the Giant Within. That was one of my first, like, exciting motivational books that I read that really I felt did change my life. By reading that book, my life was different after closing that book than it was before I even opened it. That changed my life. Older book, Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. Grant Cardone, when Grant was just a car guy. I mean, there was a day Grant wasn't the big real estate guru he is today. You know, he was just traveling the circuit, talking to dealerships. But I just think it boils down to, at the core, wanting to do what's right and wanting to feel good about what I did. And so that was really my core motivator, and caring about the people that worked for me, you know. And I think that what it did was, by doing something different and by doing things a little bit different than most dealerships are doing them, when you're motivating your staff, when you're talking to them about, hey, here's where we're at. Hey, we're climbing the ranks. Hey, we're number one in the city. Hey, now we're number one in the state. People want to be part of that. It's something to carry on. And again, that's part of, I think, the positive side of doing something like this. When you can say to your staff, guys, here's how we're doing it versus how everybody else is doing it. This is a better way. You could tell your customer this. You can, you know, motivate themselves that, hey, I'm part of a winning team. So all of the things that come together, there's so many positive benefits from doing the damn right thing that anybody arguing with it, man, it boggles my mind. It really does.
So how do you really feel about all this?
You know how I feel, baby. I don't pull no punches, man. And I will just say this. I found a great replacement for myself. I spent a year and a half training him. He's of the same mindset as I am. Great human being, great team. I mean, I don't fault anyone there. I love this store. I just went in for my 30,000 mile service on my 400 the other day and got to fellowship with everybody. But, you know, I think it's just inevitable. The day's coming. This is this part of the business. We'll get cleaned up and then everything will be fine. They've cleaned up the front. They've cleaned now. They services, you know, you don't see people selling horn fluid anymore in service departments and snake oil and that kind of stuff. So, but one thing happened to me early in my career. I had a young girl. I was younger myself. I was probably 27, 28. And she was probably 21, 22. And she had a young child. And she came in and she wanted this particular car, and that car was too much money. And she's like, Derek, here's what I can afford payment wise without, you know, compromising my family. This is where I need to be. And I think at the time it was like 250, 275. And I was like, look, that car is going to be like $400. This is a decent car. This would probably get you really close. And I think we ended up like 285 on the car. She gets into finance and she walked out of the finance office. This was before I was manager. She walked out of that finance office with like a $375 payment. And I could see the look in her eye. And I knew that little kid was going to suffer. That what we just did to her, pretty much, and excuse my language, fucked her life. And I think because I seen the look in her eye, and I knew what she had just told me, where it was not like she was just trying to get the payment lower. It was what she could afford. But she went in there and got that pressure and could not say no. And I don't know what ended up happening, but I know how it affected my life. I know how it affected me going to sleep that night. And I think in that moment, I vowed that somehow, some way, I'm going to fight against this.
Well, listeners, I'm certain that there are other people who are talking about this, but certainly you are hearing about this on Wisco Weekly first. And I do think, Derek, for coming on the show, for sharing what could be somewhat sensitive, controversial information. I actually don't think it is, and only because to the extent that as customers are buying cars, I find this to be just good, very good, solid car buying advice. And like Derek said, I mean, there's no doubt that the F&I process, the finance and insurance process, that second half of the car buying process, it's only a matter of time until there's more transparency and more exposure, to which then you don't have these high pressure sales tactics that are forcing you essentially to buy these products that may be of no value to you. And again, as we said, this happened on the front end with car sales and the fact that people can search online for invoice prices, for competitive pricing. So it's just a matter of time till you see it's on this back end portion. So Derek, sincerely, thank you for sharing your insights on this matter. It's always good to know that in addition to not just sharing your insight, but you obviously have the evidence and the results to back it up. And you also had the courage and the audacity to do things in a way that you thought was best. And I do hope that there are other dealer executives out there that do take heed of your advice. So thank you again. Listeners, be sure you visit the episode page to view Derek's YouTube channel. I will put that on the episode page. And stay tuned for another episode of Wisco Weekly. On behalf of Kelly, Rudy, and myself, as we end every episode, cheers, prost, l'chaim kippis, nastravi, salut, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, nastrovie, to the customer experience.